Before I go any further, please allow me to also once again express my deepest gratitude to Your Eminence for inviting me to this retreat. It's an honor, and I'm deeply flattered. And I couldn't say no to Archbishop Joseph because of my knowledge of him and my coming to know him so many, many years ago, and the kindness that he has shown me through these years. I also have a kind of special affinity to the Antiochian church and the students at our school and to the priests that I have known through the years. So it has been a distinct honor to be in your presence and to wish you well in your ministries. And I also want to thank you for your generosity, and kind of floored me. So thank you very, very much for that as well. His Eminence also asked me to say something about receiving converts into the Orthodox Church. Now, the comments that I'm making are going to be disjointed because it comes from a long paper that I had also prepared for our archdiocese. In fact, because they are reviewing the process by which to accept the converts into the church. So I hope it's not too disjointed or too long, and somebody ought to stop me if we are going over time. The way by which converts are received into the church is or should be a matter of concern for the Orthodox churches in America, chiefly for two reasons, one theoretical, the other practical. First, as with other canonical and liturgical matters, the absence of a consistent policy and a uniform practice is an unnecessary irritant and a source of scandal. It creates confusion, and more importantly, it raises questions about the soundness of the theology behind each practice. Is each one equally true? Adding to the confusion are the several interpretations of ecclesiastical economy, economia, used to support and justify a particular practice of reception. Does each interpretation of the economia, as Professor Louis Patsavos, the canonist, observes, does each one reflect the true sense of the principle of ecclesiastical economy? Undoubtedly, to justify present-day conditions, some will point to the ancient church when diversity of practice was a fact. However, the historical record also shows that variety of practice did not exist within a local church. How then can the Orthodox churches in America, though not yet united administratively, they nevertheless constitute a local church in principle? So how then the Orthodox churches in America justify divergent practices, especially when these differences bear directly upon the principles of ecclesiology and sacramental theology? Although there were divergent practices in the ancient church, it is important to note that their theological underpinnings did not go unchallenged. For example, St. Cyprian's ecclesiology, with its narrow sense of the limits of the church, his categorical rejection of all sacraments performed outside the canonical church, and his insistence on the rebaptism of all heterodox converts, schismatics, and heretics alike, never enjoyed broad application in the East or the West. In fact, as we shall see if we get a chance, in the canonical and liturgical tradition of the East, heterodox baptism was neither rejected nor accepted outright. Its validity was determined essentially by the proximity of the group's theology to the Orthodox faith and the group's ability to manifest love as a true measure of authentic discipleship. The second reason for uneasiness about the lack of uniformity in receiving converts is of a more practical nature, a pastoral concern. There are individual clergy within the several jurisdictions who have been influenced by the writings of modern proponents of Cyprianic ecclesiology. With a narrow understanding of heresy and a legalistic, excessively strict approach to the canons, there are clergymen among us who, contrary to the prevailing official position of the church, insist on rebaptizing all heterodox converts, including Roman Catholic and mainline Protestant Christians. Such subjective behavior places one above the church and leads to arbitrary actions that undermine ecclesial authority and invite chaos. Sometimes these things are done secretly. Priest decides on his own to rebaptize people unbeknownst even to his bishop. He has become a bishop unto himself. The need to rebaptize all heretics and schismatics rests on the belief that they were never truly baptized. The term then, rebaptism, although convenient, is misleading and problematic. It cannot be construed as a second baptism, for that would be contrary to the church's faith as expressed in the creed. I acknowledge one baptism for the forgiveness of sins. The insistence on rebaptizing all heterodox converts, regardless of confessional origin, is in fact an unapologetic belief in the complete absence of grace outside the canonical borders of the church. But the canonical and liturgical tradition of the church does not mirror such an absolute position, which is based essentially on the ecclesiology of Saint Cyprian. In 1966, the Standing Conference of Canonical Orthodox Bishops, SCOBA, addressed the issue of the reception of converts within the broader context of the Church's involvement in ecumenical relations by issuing a set of directives. These directives were incorporated into SCOBA's Guidelines for Orthodox Christians in Ecumenical Relations. An expanded version of the guidelines was published in 1973, which continues to be in force, although not considered an official ecclesiastical document, so jurisdictions can observe it or not. In the absence of a comprehensive set of directives and a commonly accepted authorized rite or rites of reception, even in outline form, the clergy continue to receive converts in accordance with the customs and traditions of their respective jurisdictions. So the SCOBA guidelines have not been able to create a viable uniform practice of reception. It still escapes us, which is another sign of the disjuncture and of the many perils it harbors. The several reception procedures of the jurisdictions have been studied recently by Professor John Erickson. Many of you had him as your professor, and he is a friend. He was able to distinguish among these rites, three major lines or approaches, which for the purpose of convenience, he calls the Russian approach, the Greek approach, and the conflations of the two. More importantly, he was able to discern that each of these approaches reveal not only diversity of practice, but also divergent approaches to ecclesiology and sacramental theology. I will briefly refer to the three approaches. The Russian approach, according to Father Erickson, was pioneered by Peter Mogila, the Metropolitan of Kiev in the 17th century. According to this approach, mainline Trinitarian Protestants, as well as unconfirmed Roman or Latin Catholics, are to be received by chrismation following the full post-baptismal rite of the Orthodox Church. While the baptism of Trinitarian Protestants is considered valid, it is nevertheless incomplete for two reasons. The Russian approach. Protestants lack apostolic succession, which is deemed essential for the church. As a result, they do not have a valid sacrament of chrismation. Unconfirmed Catholics who never underwent confirmation, this theory has, are received by chrismation simply because they never partook of the sacrament of confirmation. Baptized and confirmed Latin Catholics, Nestorians, and non-Chalcedonians, on the other hand, are to be received by a profession of faith, since they have valid orders and therefore valid sacraments of baptism and chrismation. As we shall see below, the reception of Latin converts by profession of faith alone runs contrary to the Greek approach. As Father Erickson observes, the Russian approach offers a clear and coherent modern application of the Canon 95 of the Trullo Synod, the Panthecti. Moreover, as he notes, Mogila and his heirs relate the completion of Christian initiation to the presence of apostolic ministry, a line of reasoning already used in the 4th century. A series of reception rites, according to the Russian approach, have been incorporated in the Great Book of Needs, compiled and translated from the Slavic version of the Evangelion. The same rites are also found in the service book of the Holy Orthodox Catholic Apostolic Church, compiled and translated by Isabella Hapgood, about which we spoke the other day. Subsequently, another service that was created and published by the Russian Church. Incidentally, a condensed version rite based entirely on the services of the Great Book of Needs and in Hapgood's service book was published in 1995 by Father Spencer Kezios, a Greek priest here in California, respected, who presented as the approach of the Greek church, but it is not. It comes directly out of the Russian tradition. The Greek approach. Here I have to be very succinct because the majority of the paper is focused on that to draw the difficulties in the Greek approach. The Greek approach, Father Erickson notes, is less well known and is more difficult to interpret since it has not had a smooth, continuous history, and that's true. He is correct in this assessment. The Greek approach, rooted in ancient synodical decisions, has in the last several centuries undergone changes prompted both by historical events as well as theological argumentation. In broad terms, the modes of reception in the Greek East were determined by the relevant canons of the local and ecumenical synods. Although in some ecclesial circles the baptism of heretics and schismatics was categorically rejected, rebaptism of all heterodox never became the normative practice of the church, since not all who were outside the canonical borders of the church were considered heretics in the strict sense. Saint Basil the Great, and we'll get to him later, used a threefold distinction to identify those outside the church, designating them according to the content of their faith and their relationship to the church as heretics, schismatics, or dissidents. Canons of local and ecumenical synods made the similar distinctions that Saint Basil made. In the 4th century, again, and in the 7th century, the process of reception was clearly defined by the Second Ecumenical Synod in Canon 7 and the Panthecti Synod, or the Trullo Synod, in Canon 95. These are the two key canons of the church regarding the reception of converts, and have determined to a great deal the Greek approach, since we are still on the Greek approach. But that became a real problem after the split with the Western churches, the Protestant Reformation, and the events of the 18th century, key to understanding the difficulties in the Greek approach. The three modes of reception, which were introduced by the canons of the second and sixth ecumenical council, the the Penthecti, are also introduced in the Ευχολόγια, or service books of the church, and especially in the earliest, as we said before, codex, the Barberini Codex, which in fact has services for the reception of converts based on an almost verbatim quoting the Penthecti Synod. Following the schism of 1054, the East had a new problem. Let me remind you, and we will say this later, that both the canons of the two synods, the second and the sixth, name the convert, the schismatics and the heretics. They're named, how each is to be received. But after 1054, we have a new problem. Something not foreseen by the previous synodical decisions: how to receive Latin Christians. Initially, Latins were admitted to communion directly, but by the 12th century, as the canonist Theodore Vasamon indicates, the reception of Latins had become more formalized, accomplished by catechism and a certificate of faith. This is a technical title, a livelos. This mode of reception was to change again as the schism deepened. A host of socio-political and religious factors contributed to the change in attitudes toward the Latins, including the Crusades and the establishment of a series of Latin states and bishoprics in former territories of the East, papal religious propaganda, including the problems of conversion, and political manipulation further intensified the antipathies of the populace. Latin liturgical practices, including baptism by effusion or aspersion, offended Orthodox theological and pastoral sensibilities. As the Byzantine Empire began to disintegrate and the attempts at union failed, theological positions hardened. By the end of the 15th century, Latin converts were received by a livelos and by chrismation. In rare circumstances, they were rebaptized, but only in response to Latin abuses. Latins rebaptized, the Orthodox rebaptized. We'll show them. The reception of Latins by chrismation was regularized in the Synod of 1484. Declaring Latin baptism valid, the Synod decreed that Latin converts were to be catechized properly and received through a livelos and a special rite of chrismation. Not the baptismal rite, the special rite of chrismation, which the Synod created and disseminated. This service is of special interest and will be discussed below. During the ensuing two centuries, the church was obliged to deal with the reception of converts from the churches of the Protestant Reformation. The modes of their reception was regularized by the synodical decisions of the 17th and 18th centuries. According to these conciliar rulings, Protestant converts from the Lutheran, Calvinist, and Anglican confessions were already baptized in the name of the Holy Trinity were received by catechism, a livelos, and chrismation. Protestant converts from lesser known groups whose baptism was suspect were baptized. And that particular last part also affects our modern day situation. For the Greek, again, since we're in the Greek approach, the state of affairs in the Greek church changed dramatically in 1755, and this affects the entire Eastern church, the other ancient patriarchates, and you'll see why. In 1755, during a time of strong anti-papal and anti-Western feelings, Cyril, the fifth patriarch of Constantinople, on his own initiative, despite the objections of the Patriarchal Synod, issued a decree entitled, this is the whole title of the decree, Definition of the Holy Church of Christ, defending the holy baptism given from God and spitting upon the baptisms of the heretics which are otherwise administered. Well, you know the tone of that. By which he ordered the rebaptism of all heterodox converts without distinction. A year later, in 1756, Cyril's decree was sanctioned by the patriarchates of the East and held sway through the greater part of the 19th century, despite the serious objections of many. More will, of course, will said about the addition I will say later, but more importantly, the definition which provoked the thing nevertheless found supporters, especially in the writings of Saint Nicodemus the Argyritis and the Pedalion, which confirmed the stance of Cyril the Fifth. More importantly, the definition of Cyril has never been officially rescinded. The Patriarchate of Constantinople, however, in 1888, reverted to its earlier practices, approved and promulgated by synodical decrees. So the decision of 1888 of the Patriarchate of Constantinople constitutes today the official Greek approach observed by all the quote, Greek churches, those under the Patriarchate or influenced by the Patriarchate, albeit with local variations, as usually happens. Nonetheless, there are within the Greek church, even today, monastic communities and theologians who still cling to the strict, rigorous positions exemplified in the Rudder, the Pedalion, and the Cyril's Edict. Now to the third of the categories. Professor Erickson uses the term conflations to describe the third line of approach to reception. In North America, he says, one may find not only the Russian practice and the Greek practice, but also some conflations of the two, in which the logic behind each is obscured. Father Erickson cites two examples of the conflation approach. One from the Priest's Guide of the Antiochian Orthodox Christian Archdiocese, and the other from the 1989 service of the reception of converts of the Orthodox Church in America. The Antiochian Priest's Guide, which you know better than I do, and you read it, and I stand to be corrected. This guide, according to the guide, converts are to be received by instruction and affirmation of the Orthodox faith and chrismation. The directors, however, make no distinction between converts and specify no particular service of chrismation. Presumably, all converts are to be received in like manner. This is the guidebook before we get to the service. That, in all probability, early on, the Antiochian clergy had have recourse to one liturgical source for the service of reception, Isabella Hot Goods, the service book of the Holy Orthodox Church. But as Professor Erickson points out, the service of reception in Hapgood reflects the Russian practice intended for Protestant converts. Late in 1988, however, the Antiochian Archdiocese issued a service for the chrismation of converts, quote, service of converts into the Orthodox faith. This service was compiled for the Department of Liturgics and Translations by Father Edward Hughes, a priest of the Archdiocese and a good friend from New England. In a brief introduction, the compiler states that the basic form and text of the service is based on the Barberini Codex and the service of the Synod of 1484. He also states that the service is in accord with the provisions of the Panthecti Synod and the policy of the Patriarchate of Antioch, which has required chrismation of all converts who have had a Trinitarian baptism. This service is, in fact, a conflation, the service of 1888 of the Antiochian Archdiocese, with elements from the Russian services, the Barberini Codex, and the received rite of baptism. The booklet containing the service, however, contains three very helpful introductory pieces that are missing from other such service books. The first concerns the candidate, listing the prerequisites for reception, which include a verification of his or her Trinitarian baptism with water, a proper period of catechesis, a confession of sins, and a profession of faith. Let me just indicate something here. I'm not in position to discuss it in detail, but this provision in your service book that requires a confession of sins is not found in rubrics of the earlier orders for the reception of converts. So it raises a question. It's a valid question. But you have that in your tradition now, at least since 1988. The second concerns the period of instruction, which is very important, and that this period should be from 6 months to a year in length. In other words, the convert doesn't come in and say, I'd like to be a church, and the priest says, that's great, welcome. Next week, we'll chrismate you. You know, that kind of attitude that somebody, it sets a limit. You have to do this for this amount of time. Remembering that all in the earlier, more ancient documents, the pattern of conversion was patterned after the baptism of catechumens. And one of the, remember we said the first day, underneath all this is a resocialization process, changing the ethos. And that's why instruction and time is important. And in order to assist in the process of instruction, this booklet and pamphlet also has several currently available resources for instruction. It lists the sources. The third piece is especially useful, which is missing from all others, including the Greek tradition. It has a list of 50 plus Protestant denominations which traditionally affirm the dogma of the Holy Trinity and baptize in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. That list is very useful, so that a priest who is not knowledgeable in these things says, well, my archdiocese has a sanctioned list of people whom I can receive. I think that that list from time to time needs to always be evaluated. That's my thought. In 1989, The OCA service, according to Father Erickson, is beset with problems. The structure and prayers of the OCA service, which is this conflation that he speaks about, are basically those of the post-baptismal rite as they would be employed in the Russian practice, and considers this a weakness. With this business of instruction, because I'm skipping pages here, especially instructive are the decisions that have to do with the reception of Latins and with the reception of Protestants. In these conciliar documents, the issues are raised of what separates us from these other churches, so that it is not simply essential to instruct the convert with what the church believes and does with regards to theology and liturgy and discipline, but also to address the issues that are pertinent to a Roman Catholic, to a Protestant. And that these conciliar decisions, 1484 and the 17th century synod decisions, indicate the thrust of the catechesis. I could say, for example, when we are catechizing a Roman Catholic, we don't have to make a big issue over seven sacraments. They accept the seven sacraments. Maybe a more refined theological understanding of the sacraments as to the nuances. But you don't spend all your time speaking about the sacraments. But you will discuss the meaning of the filioque, why it's important. And of course, Roman theology now is beginning to revise or restate, I should say better, its understanding of the filioque. Papal authority, the issue of the Immaculate Conception, why it is important to make a note of the why that is a doctrinal issue and not just a devotional issue, and things like that. When you have a Protestant convert, it's very important to speak about the communion of saints, the use of icons, the need for liturgical conformity and unity, the sacraments beyond baptism and Eucharist, and what is the Eucharist, the real presence, and all that other stuff. So the emphases are there that we need to, so this is something that we need to consider. I mentioned this before, and I have a section that deals with economia, the use of economia, and it's much too long to get into it now. But you see, we have yet as a church to have a clear definition of what economy is and how it should be used. We are still trying to refine and understand economy. Even the pre-conciliar committee that dealt with this issue in preparation for the Great and Holy Synod came out with a document on economia. It was set aside because at least five Greek theologians objected fiercely to the document. So you see, we're still trying to understand economia, its theory, and its use. Let me just make a few more comments here. What constitutes heresy? Who is a heretic, and who is a schismatic? I don't know about you, my dear brothers, but sometimes I'm deeply offended by some of our own clergy. Every time you speak about some of all those heretics, you know, this vehemence, you know. So who are heretics, and what does it mean to be a heretic? Who is a schismatic? There is a tendency today to label heretical most, if not all, non-Orthodox communities outside the canonical limits of the Orthodox Church. However, the patristic, canonical, and liturgical tradition of the Church is far more nuanced and more precise than we claim in our day. Although there were strong opinions even in Christian antiquity over the way converts were to be received, the general consensus was to make distinctions between heretics and schismatics. The heterodox, as I mentioned before, were categorized into groups on the basis of their closeness or distance from the Orthodox faith. The manner of their reception was assigned accordingly. In general, the heterodox were placed within three general groupings: heretics, schismatics, and dissidents. In his famous letter to Amphilochius on the canons, Saint Basil the Great tells us that the local churches at various times and places used different ways to receive heretics and schismatics. In response to Amphilochius' inquiry, Saint Basil stated that in the tradition of the ancients, that's the Usy words, in the tradition of the ancients, there are three kinds of groups that exist outside the canonical boundaries of the Church: heretics, schismatics, and dissidents, which he defined as follows. And we would do well to keep in mind the definitions of Saint Basil. Heretics, according to Saint Basil, are those groups that claim to be Christian, but in fact are not, because their understanding of the triune God is radically different, highly deficient, unrecognizable, and irreconcilable with the Church's faith. That's a heresy. The baptism of these groups is clearly null and void and has no substance because they are not Christian. Hence, converts from such groups are to be received as pagans and non-believers through the entire rite of baptism. Saint Basil describes schismatics as those Christians who are separated from the Church for holding positions and opinions that are dissimilar from those of the Church, but which nonetheless are resolvable and repairable. Schisms are those at variance with one another for certain ecclesiastical reasons and questions that admit to remedy. They can be remedied. Thus, in keeping with tradition, with the ancients, as he said, Saint Basil held the opinion that the baptism of schismatics is acceptable on the ground that they are, quote, still of the Church, os eti ectis ecclesias ondon, that they have vestige of Church in them. Those separated from the Church by defects that are curable, schismatics should be treated as having vestiges or marks of the Church. That's very significant, and of course is contrary to Cyprianic ecclesiology. Dissidents are groups that form rival and illicit communities, parasynagogia, in opposition to legitimate ecclesial authority. Dissident congregations and assemblies, St. Basil says, are brought into being by insubordinate presbyters or bishops and by uninstructed laymen. Their separation is caused by insubordination and not doctrinal differences. According to the descriptions provided by St. Basil, heretics, properly speaking, are those whose doctrines are alien and totally dissimilar from the faith of the Church. However, in time, Most, if not all, heretics came to be called heretics by extension. We would do well in our own times to use the label heretic with greater care and precision. Do you think maybe I should stop here? Is it time not to go any further? Maybe we should leave it here because I don't want to... The important thing, again, let me say that the two canons of the councils name the heretics per se, and they also name the schismatics, among whom, this is very significant, Arians, Nestorians, Monophysites later. Arians must be accepted not through baptism but chrismation. Nestorians and Monophysites simply by a livelos, a certificate of faith. These are eye-opening things. So I'll leave it at that.